Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council made possible by Chevron. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Today's program features on U.S.-Russian relations, from NATO to disagreements over Syria to evidence of Russian cyber attacks in the United States. Russia is a renewed source of concern for the President of the United States. It will be one of the challenges facing the incoming administration. In this hour, we'll hear from Masha Gessen, who is a journalist and author, and Catherine Stoner, senior fellow at the Center for Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at Stanford University. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Robert English of the University of Southern California.
It's my great pleasure and my honor to be the moderator for this panel on Russia. My distinguished panelists, to my immediate left, Masha Gessen. I think for many of us, the non-specialists, she came to broad attention with the publication several years ago of Man Without a Face, an incisive biography of Putin and his regime. And she also has a forthcoming book, The Future is History, about Russia today and tomorrow. And she's written extensively in The New Republic, The New York Review of Books, many, many other venues, right? One of our most incisive observers of contemporary Russia. And to her left, Catherine Stoner also has lots of books and numerous articles to her credit. I first came to know her, as many of our academic colleagues did, with Local Heroes. She has held academic appointments, studied or taught everywhere that matters, McGill, Harvard, Columbia, Princeton, and at present is at Stanford University. I guess the Center for Democracy, Rule of Law, something.
Democracy, Development, yeah. And the Rule of Law.
That's all under the Spoli things. Institute, right?
All good things that go together.
All good things that go together. Right. And she also has a book on the way, Resurrected? Question mark.
Russia's return as a global power.
Russia's return as a global power. No question mark after that or declaratory. So here we have an enormous amount of knowledge. And I need to get out of the way, but provoke the beginning of a moderated discussion with a few remarks of my own. And as I thought about how to do this, it struck me, I'm squeezing a little bit into categories perhaps, but that we had represented here the three classic approaches in the study of international relations at this table. Some of you know, talk about levels of analysis, the work of Ken Waltz. The three main approaches, they begin with the realists, those who look at the balance of power in geopolitics. And state behavior is usually best explained by states contending for power, for security, for dominance in the international arena. The second level of analysis says, no, we can go inside individual states and find some of the secrets there. For example, states that are liberal and democratic tend to be less aggressive and warlike for understandable reasons. States that are more autocratic, dictatorial, more quickly resort to violence in the international arena. There are many other variations, but here is the state system level of analysis. And finally, there is the leadership or individual level. It doesn't matter so much what's happening outside, threatening or benign environment. It doesn't even matter what the system is. When you have a strong leader, their personality, their own personal objectives, and maybe their psychoses can be what drives foreign policy. I think we have all three points of view. Again, I'm squeezing us each into a particular box. I would be the geopolitics, the realist, I'll frankly admit. I think perhaps Catherine Stoner is going to talk about domestic politics as a source of international relations. And we know Masha Gessen has focused a great deal on the beliefs, the pathologies, the ambitions of the particular leader. So with that, and thank you for indulging the IR professor, the theorist in me, I'll turn first to Professor Stoner and ask her to talk a bit about that. And I guess that's another way of saying, talk a bit about what you're arguing in your latest book about how domestic politics may be driving Russia's international behavior.
Sure. So, thank you very much, Rob, and it's great to see you again. It's great to be sitting next to Masha. I guess first thing I wanted to do was to also raise this question about the title of the panel. I think it's Russia and Putin, friend or foe, right? Or new foe or renewed foe. So my book, as you mentioned, is called Resurrected? So, and I just had a little debate in the New York Times Room for Debate section with Matt Rozhansky just this week, I guess. It's been a long week. And I argue basically that there is, you're right, there is no existential reason why, or structural reason why the United States and Russia have to be enemies. And that, in fact, there have been many periods of cooperation, and we heard some of them actually just in the last panel on Iran, talking about the U.S. and Russia cooperating. And Ambassador Pickering said he could name 10 things or a dozen things the U.S. and Russia were cooperating on right now, even. So, no, I'm not a realist, and you guessed right on that. And I guess I don't see Russian power vis-a-vis the U.S. in realist terms. I see Russian power, though, as multidimensional. And so the reason that my book title is Resurrected? Is because I was just saying to Masha, you know, I bet last year the China panel was bigger than the Russia panel in terms of audience. And you know, Russia, every once in a while, I'll go to a dinner party over the last 6 months or so, and people will say to me, wow, Russia's relevant again. But Russia's always been relevant. I think that what we've seen, though, since 2014 in particular, and you could argue since 2012, when Mr. Putin came back to the presidency, is a change in the way Russia has interacted with the world. And one of the interesting puzzles about this is if you are a realist and you add up what Russia has militarily and you take into account the fact that it's 2.98% of the global economy, I think the U.S. is just under 25% of the global economy, and you look at Russia's military, which is better than it was, but it's nothing compared to the United States or to China or even to the European Union, which we don't think of as a great military power. If you add those things up, which realists do, and John Mearsheimer does, and you think like a realist, Russia doesn't really, shouldn't be so remarkable to us. It looks not like a global power or a superpower or even a great power. It looks pretty small and powerless. And yet, here we are talking about whether it's a renewed enemy and also interference in our own political, or possible interference in our own political process. So, you know, how can this be? I think there are a lot of remarkable things about Russia. First is this capacity to resurrect or to come back. It's almost exactly 25 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, right? The sickle and hammer came down over the Kremlin on December 25th, 1991, and the Russian tricolor flag went up. Mikhail Gorbachev sort of fought it all the way, and they practically had to drag him out of his office. You can still see the claw marks on the wall, kicking and screaming, but down came the Union. So 25 years of reform and change. And one of the things I think is remarkable is how far Russia has come in those 25 years. So it was in the deepest man-made recession outside of wartime following the collapse of the Soviet Union. It went through a series of very, very painful economic, social, and political reforms in the 1990s, the outcome of which was extremely uncertain, very fractious politics in the 1990s. The ruble crashes, and there's a financial crisis in 1998. It defaults on its international loans. And then the economy begins to grow again in 1999. That's before Mr. Putin becomes president in 2000. So although he takes credit for Russia's dramatic economic growth, which really occurs between 2003 and 2008, it starts a little earlier and is the product of some very tough and unpopular policy choices. Now, the other thing I think is that we can't treat Mr. Putin as just somebody who has benefited as president while oil prices went from what they were in the 90s, on average $17 a barrel, to over $120 a barrel. There have been some astute policy choices as well. So we're talking about Russia partly because it has money. It had money. Now its economy is in recession, but there are predictions the next year or so it'll come back. It is pretty much an energy export-dependent economy, and that, I think, has been one of the failures of Putin. And so when my book has Resurrected? That's a question mark. Can Russia sustain itself? Can Russia continue to project power abroad in the way that it has in the last 3 or 4 years when its economy is not diversified? There are probably very few people in the audience who can say that they bought something that says made in Russia in the last week or so. I'm sure if I asked that question next door in the China panel, that pretty much everybody's hand would go up, right? Probably bought something today. So that is an ongoing issue for Russia, and it's not clear that Mr. Putin has the capability or interest in actually making the painful decisions that will have to be made to transform the Russian economy and make its seeming resurgence durable and sustainable. So I'll stop there for now.
I guess same question for you, Masha.
Actually, my wedding ring was made in Russia.
And you were.
And I was. I was made in the Soviet Union.
That's right.
But I mean, I agree with a lot of what Catherine said. And actually, I'm going to disappoint you by not focusing on Putin's psychology so much, because I think there's something perhaps more important. And this is where I will disagree with you, which is your point about how much Russia has changed in the last 25 years. Because actually, I think it's very important to look at how much Russia hasn't changed in the last 25 years. And what I'm talking about is what's happened to Russian society over the course of the last 25 years, which is that after sort of considering for a few years the possibility of becoming something new, it decided not to. And it has very much reverted to the habits of a totalitarian society. Now, I'm not saying that Russia has a totalitarian regime, which it doesn't, right? It has a mafia regime. But the signals that come from that mafia regime are interpreted by the society as signals, as a totalitarian society would interpret signals. And the longer this goes on, the more sort of habits of a totalitarian society are resurrected in Russia. I'm resurrected now, I'm going to perseverate on that word. And this has been especially true since the political crackdown began in 4 years ago in Putin's response to the mass protests that greeted his return, his official return to the presidency in 2012. And the key difference between an authoritarian society, which I would argue Russia was before 2012, and a totalitarian society is its level of mobilization. Basically, an authoritarian society wants its citizens, its subjects, to stay home and, you know, not bother the autocrat or the single party that's running the country. Leave them alone, and it's profoundly apolitical. A totalitarian society is the exact opposite in that respect. It's highly mobilized, everything becomes political, and it wants its subjects to be out in the streets and up in arms. And that's the state that Russia is going toward, and I think that's a very important thing to remember as we consider sort of the aggression that's emanating from Russia. It is a function of domestic politics, but it's a function of that particular kind of domestic politics. It's the need to mobilize people against an enemy, to get people riled up, and to get politics to reach into every little nook and cranny.
I'd like to explore a little bit more what's happened. How did we get in this mess from the high hopes at the end of the Cold War, from the period of Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika and the early Yeltsin years? And I still think it's useful to talk a bit about everything that happened to Russia to understand both elite and popular attitudes. So I'll ask both of you, maybe I'll start with Catherine because you made an allusion to this, the economy. And we know that the 90s were a disaster in many respects. Maybe some market foundations were laid and the state backed off, but oligarchs stepped in, and all statistics show just a decade of misery and suffering. And so forth. Well, many statistics do. And then there's the final crisis at the end of the decade, the financial collapse of late 98, 99, and things begin turning around. Oil prices eventually help a great deal. The currency, which had been ridiculously overvalued, is finally devalued, which begins making many Russian industries competitive with imports and able to export. And you alluded to other positive policy steps. And these mean under the presidency of the early Putin, liberalizing reforms. You speak a bit about them, and again, what happened from the early to the mid to the later 2000s?
From 2000 to 2004, Putin won, let's call him. I think he was really learning the job, came in with this notion of dictatorship of law, which turns out to have just been dictatorship. He did not have, and if you go back and read this this little pamphlet that was made in just as he became president, called "At Perva Valitsa," from the first person, it's basically a little gang of journalists was encouraged to follow him around because the world and also a lot of Russia didn't know very much about him. So there's some choice quotes in that book if you haven't read it recently. It's pretty funny. Actually, parts of it are quite funny. To me, anyway. But he was kind of an accidental politician, and he got into this because Yeltsin asked him, and at first he said no. And he had never really led anything on his own. He always worked for someone else, kind of like Medvedev, who's always worked for Putin. It's interesting to see the evolution to somebody who is so now self-confident and arrogant in many respects. So yesterday morning, I was watching the live broadcast of him at the Valdai International Conference. The presidential administration in Russia has this peculiar annual conference. There are probably other countries in the world that do this, but I'm not aware of them, where they invite so-called specialists or experts from around the world to explain Russia to them, and then have you go out and tell other people what Russia is all about. And Putin comes to it. So I've actually been, I don't know if you, have you guys gone? Maybe,
okay. I've never been invited for some reason.
So I was invited once and then never again. It's a bizarre thing, but it's fascinating. He comes and he spends an hour and a half to 2 hours, sometimes longer. And one of the impressive things is that over time he's become, as I said, more and more confident. And also, if we want to bring in American politics here, Mr. Trump is way overestimating, I think, his own abilities, dare I say, relative to Vladimir Putin. They are not birds of a feather. Putin is, he's running his country into the ground, I think, for domestic political reasons. However, he is a policy wonk. I mean, he knows things. He can answer policy questions. Now, sometimes what he would turn to as facts would be different from what you might turn to as facts. But he's quite impressive in person this way, in a way that I think few leaders are these days. But that said, some of the policies have been beneficial. I mean, one puzzle we've always had is, Putin, as I just said, I think is ultimately running his country into the ground, but Russians love him. He's so popular. Now, why is that? I think some of it is what Masha said, right? Over time, so as we move from Putin 1 to Putin 2, then the Medvedev period, baby Putin, back to Putin 3, you can see that, one reason is, one of the first things he does is dominate the media, right? So he uses the central government's ability to license media outlets to get rid, really, of free press. And that's done by about 2004, 2005. The other thing, though, that they do is as oil prices go up in 2000, it starts in 2003 and it goes up to about 2008, Russia's growing about 7.5% year on year. And I have said in previous talks that a trained monkey could have manage the Russian economy at this time, which is basically true, except for a few funds. One is the National Reserve Fund, which is putting money away from oil revenues for a rainy day. And so this turned out to actually be something that was very useful in a kind of ultimately failed attempt to save the ruble in 2008 and 9 as the economy was crashing with the global economic crisis. And then he also appointed a very good, I think, central bank chairwoman. Russia actually, and she's relatively independent. I wouldn't ever say completely independent, but she's been allowed to make some good policy choices. He's kind of stayed out of that. And so, the economy has definitely, by 2012, before the Ukraine debacle and before Crimea and before sanctions, the economy was already beginning to decline. So that's where bad decisions come in, and that's where, you know, sort of this, as you said, you call it mafia, the rent seeking and having the friends around benefiting and getting contracts for infrastructure and not investing in diversification of the economy. Now the piper is being paid for that. And I think one reason we're seeing a more aggressive Russia is the social contract has had to change. It's not that I'm going to triple your incomes year on year, and frankly, I think any president, if they did that, or happened to be in office when it happened, would be popular, and that's what's happened. And then if you watch Russia, how many people watch Russian television? Probably a few. I've been for a few presidential elections, and I would vote for the guy. I mean, he is everywhere. It's so impressive. He's pulling amphoras out of the Black Sea. He is, my favorite clip, actually, you can see this on YouTube, is when he's putting out fires from a plane. It's great. And the pilot says to him, okay, Mr., I think he was prime minister then, you can drop it now. And he does. And the pilot then turns to Putin and says, perfect hit. It's great. So he's single-handedly putting out these forest fires around Russia. So, I mean, you know, he dominates the news in a very positive way. And there is no opposition. Partly that's the opposition's fault, but it's also by design, right? And so that partly explains, I think, why he's so popular. There's no alternative. I think one reason, and then I'll stop here. One reason Russia or the foreign policy has become more aggressive is because the economy has gone into decline. So this social contract of, look, you can give up some of your rights and be quiet, don't demonstrate society, and in return, your standard of living will improve. So when I say how much Russia has changed, I was thinking about when in 1988 or 1989, you tried to make a phone call from Moscow to Vladivostok, and you had to wait. And maybe you'd be able, maybe it would go through, maybe it wouldn't, and an international call was even worse. Now, you know, cell phones and whatnot. So from that point of view, I think it's changed a lot. But I would agree that Russian society is complicated. And there has been compliance, but there's also been repression. And I think we see the economic incline came at the same time as we get a decline in pluralism and quality of elections and freedom of speech.
Masha, can you speak a bit about this incipient totalitarianism or these signs and these currents that are developing in that direction? And in particular, how far it could go, how quickly? And I'm going to pick up on something Catherine just said about phone calls, internet, and I'm just taking from that point of view, meaning access to information and openness. No doubt the state media are Putin's propaganda channels. But again, if we travel to China, Gulf countries, many other, for comparative sake, we see real censorship, real internet control, real denial of any information. And Russia is still a long way from that, and people who want to can still much more freely sample the outside world, travel there if they can afford it, read about it here. What do you expect? I guess just respond to that. Do you see more media controls and more social media, internet, computer controls making it possible truly to cut off alternative sources of information and perspectives and really erect a kind of psychological iron curtain that will enable real totalitarianism and full control of people's thoughts to emerge?
Right. Well, you know, the problem with totalitarianism as a concept is that there has never been real totalitarianism, there will never be real totalitarianism, because it is impossible, you know. So totalitarianism always tries to be totalitarianism, though in the same way, actually, that democracy is always trying to be democracy, except that they're sort of the opposite of each other. Even during the decades of state terror, which was between 1924 and 1953 in the Soviet Union, even then there wasn't real totalitarianism in the sense that not every single person was fully, with all their being, a part of the state whole, right? It's always a matter of degree. And as the Soviet Union developed toward the 1980s, after 1953, after Stalin's death, it developed a sort of economy of terror, right? It turned out that you could actually apply the terrorizing functions of the police state selectively. And if you did it well enough, you know, the society was in control, in part because society had the memory of state terror, right? Now it has the memory of state terror. But so far, that's proving to be enough, right? And the ways that we're seeing that play out is, and that is directly related to your question about censorship, is let's look at, for example, how censorship is enforced in Russia today. It, you know, back in the Soviet Union, censorship existed officially. There was a censorship agency. There were censors at every single media outlet. Those censors actually reviewed books and articles before they were published, and they could either clear them for publication or not clear them for publication. So it was classic sort of prior censorship. Now, Russia legally doesn't have censorship. It has an oversight agency that has the power to, the discretionary power to blacklist publications, including websites. And it has laws, most notably the two laws, the Law on the Protection of Children from Harmful Information, also known as the Law for the Protection of Children from Information, that is completely unenforceable. And this is a mark of laws that totalitarian societies and totalitarian states like, because they place everybody outside the law, right? Everyone is a criminal, so you can always enforce this this law in a selective manner, and you can only enforce it in a selective manner because it can't possibly be enforced fully and equally, because everyone is a criminal under this law. And there's the law on extremism, and extremism, nobody knows what extremism is, but for example, when my editor in Moscow went to talk to his lawyer, his publishing house's lawyers about whether they could publish my book about Pussy Riot, the lawyer said, well, yeah, but she mentions Putin a lot, and that's extremism. So my editor said, and he actually came to me with a suggestion, said, what if we black out the word Putin every time it appears? And I'm like, oh my God, that would be beautiful. I would love that.
Draws more attention to
it. I know, it's wonderful. Think about what kind of how you have to think as a lawyer to say that that the word Putin in a book constitutes extremism. But that's how that law has been enforced. But the example that I just gave with the lawyers is actually how censorship works, right? It's not that that somebody has actually stopped my book on Putin from being published in Russia. It's that no publisher, three publishers have bid on it, one has paid for it, and none of them have published it, because at some point or another, somebody in the publishing house says, well, you know, the one argument I've heard relayed back to me is, this is taking a huge risk, and if we take this risk, then the tax inspectors are going to come and raid us, and they're going to shut us down for tax violations, because of course we have tax violations, because everybody does, because tax laws are also structured in such a way that everyone is a criminal, right? And so they didn't publish the book, and then a couple of months later, after they didn't publish the book, the tax inspectors came, raided the publishing house, and they were there was a hostile takeover. And at another publishing house, the business side said, well, sure, we can publish the book, but the bookstores are never going to accept it, because the bookstores are scared of being raided. So because we're not going to be able to distribute the book, this is not censorship, right? This is profit-based reasoning. Because we're not going to be able to distribute the book, then we're not going to publish the book, right? Has the book been censored? No, it hasn't been censored. But this is really a variant of a mechanism on which Soviet society relied, right? which was in Russian it's called Круговая порука, which the great Russian sociologist Yuri Levada called it collective hostage taking, right? Everyone is always held hostage to everyone else's behavior. Everyone is people are interdependent, and everyone becomes an enforcer in this system, right? So again, to give you another example that has to do with book publishing, after the law on the protection of children from information went into effect, and it demanded, you know, crazy things like a distance of something like, I think, 100 meters between the shelves in a bookstore where adult books are shelved and children's books are shelved, you know, which is a physical impossibility, so everyone is a criminal. It also said that children's books cannot contain any information on sex, violence, death, and something else. Anyway, I mean, that it basically placed every single fairy tale ever written outside the law, among other things. So a self-constituted group of citizen enforcers that called itself the Parents of the Urals went to a local bookstore and a local library with a list of books and demanded that those books be removed from the bookstores and the libraries. And they were all the same sort of book. They were from different publishers, but they were all like books for children about their bodies. So most of them translated from English. Basic sort of, you know, how to deal with puberty books. The books were immediately disappeared from the shelves. The publishers were, had to hire lawyers, had to commission expert opinions on the books. The expert opinions actually said that the books didn't violate the law. And then eventually, when the case went to court, they won in court. The books weren't found to violate the law on the protection of children from information, but those books have disappeared. Right, so one of the bigger publishers has pulped those books. The smaller publishers got rid of, who couldn't afford to pulp them, got rid of them through other ways, through sort of semi-underground networks, the sales networks. But they will never publish books like that again because they can't afford to. So that answers your question about one aspect of what makes this society a totalitarian society, which is this lateral enforcement. And the state has really gone out of its way to encourage this, to sort of outsource enforcement, and in many cases outsource violence to these vigilante groups. As for information, I think you probably have an overly optimistic view of the amount of information that people in Russia have access to. At this point, all electronic media are controlled by the state and have been controlled by the state for more than 15 years. So that's an entire generation of Russians who have grown up watching Putin TV, right? I'm not even saying how much it has influenced Putin himself that he has been watching Putin TV.
And I've been watching it. I've been watching it too and been influenced.
Yeah. It's mind warping. Yeah. And soul destroying.
Mesmerizing.
Yeah. And mesmerizing, yes. There's really no independent radio. There's a tiny amount of independent print media. There's basically one weekly magazine that's truly independent, that has no funding, it has no advertisers, because it's much easier to put pressure on advertisers than it is on journalists, right? Because advertisers will lose their business if they advertise on these publications. So there are a few online media outlets left. The larger ones have been purged, right? So there are a couple of smaller ones left, but they have had to go to a subscription-only model because they have no advertising. So only people who are willing to pay for this content actually get this content. And it's a perfect model because, you've got your ghetto for, 200,000 people, which is probably an optimistic estimate of the entire subscription base of all these independent online publications, who get to read their own publications and let off steam by writing for these publications. It's probably the same people reading and writing. And everyone else is watching Putin TV and listening to Putin radio. And you don't have to shut this down. You know, in very much the same way that in the late Soviet Union, you didn't really have to arrest everybody who listened to Radio Free Europe. They could, you know, spend their time and let off steam by listening to Radio Free Europe that didn't threaten the state.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Marcia Gessen, a journalist and author, and Catherine Stoner, a senior fellow at the Center for Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law at Stanford University. They're in conversation with Robert English of the University of Southern California. This event was recorded in San Francisco as part of the World Affairs Annual Conference. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our moderator, Robert English.
I have time for one more round, and then organizers tell me it goes to the audience. So I want to turn it back to foreign policy, qua foreign policy. And let me lay out, I guess I'll credit it to Mearsheimer, this sort of geopolitics or the realist view of what's gone wrong, which contains suggestions of what might go better in the future, and let you knock it down or tell me, both of you, what's credible and what's not credible in it. And probably it's, in broad outline, widely known to all. At the end of the Cold War, Berlin Wall collapsed, Soviet Union collapsed. There was a tacit or somewhat explicit promise not to expand NATO, not to take advantage of Russia's geopolitical weakness, include Russia as a full partner. But that didn't happen in the 90s. I'll skip over a lot of particular incidents and we come to the 2000s. Many saw that in 2001, because of 9/11, there was sort of a renewed period of warmer relations because we had a common foe in terrorism, and indeed Putin's first moves seemed very conciliatory, and he offered intelligence collaboration, access to bases and overflight and so forth to aid in the Americans' fight with the Taliban, and that what he got in return were trade sanctions. He got the ABM treaty torn up. He got another round of NATO expansion, this time right up to Russia's borders, and so forth. Many other things could be cited leading up to, I suppose, the invasion of Iraq, which set the Middle East aflame, even more to Russia's detriment than ours. So this is the usual laundry list of criticisms of U.S. foreign policy in its treatment of Russia. And so there's an implicit question in there. Might things have gone differently if the U.S. had pursued different policies, including maybe not the expansion of NATO, at least not in the fashion it was done? In the Clinton administration, in the Bush administration again, I don't know at what where there were any turning points, or do you see either the 90s or the 2000s, Russian politics, and therefore foreign policy, so overwhelmingly determined by domestic, the things you've both been discussing sources.
Oh, they're disgusting.
They're disgusting too. That it wouldn't have mattered what the US or other, NATO as an alliance did, which, let me just put in one plug for the undefended realists here, would be remarkable in world history, that a great power, not a superpower, but a great regional power, could simply ignore the expansion of a military alliance bases on its borders. This is why people like Mearsheimer and other realists, and don't forget, the IR profession was united in its warning about the expansion of NATO, not just George Kennan or Paul Nitze, but everyone, because all of history taught that when you make this move, you'll cause a counter move. And indeed, many of those backing NATO expansion, like Brzezinski, explicitly said, we need to do this now to take advantage of Russia's weakness, because Russia will be back and we have to be ready. And so for many, there was never any intention to treat Russia equally, but to take advantage of its weakness. Do you think different policies in the 90s, under the Clinton administration, or in the early 2000s by the George W. Bush administration, might have made possible less hostility and a greater degree of cooperation? And I guess finally, before I hand it over, give me long answers, what about the 20-teens? Or have opportunities for any kind of rapprochement and security understanding just gone by the wayside because Putin is wholly dependent on Cold War and wants friction because it serves his domestic interests in almost a very Stalin-like fashion?
Okay, so that's...
That's a lot, I'm that's, sorry.
Yeah, fair amount there, Rob. All right, so I guess I see a big 20 there. I'm not sure what that means.
We're close to cut us off and let the audience
I see, okay. So first is what I would call the Weimar Russia scenario. So let me just knock that down, okay? John Mearsheimer, I think, is completely wrong and honestly should be slightly ashamed as an academic. He was at the Valdai conference this week, yeah, because he's buddies now. Anyway, so first of all, what did they get? Well, there was no written down promise that NATO would not expand, and this has been a ceremonial joust, a war of words, and even good old Gorbachev, who I know we all think of as kind of warm and fuzzy and sweet, still alive and kicking, hawking bags for Louis Vuitton, actually, has said, they told me, it was me they told. It's very unclear that that was said, and if it was, it was never written down, and you know that. The other thing is that what did they get?
But that's not really the argument. It's not to quibble over in what form the promise was delivered. It's the larger argument that taking advantage of the other side's weakness and thrusting your alliance into the neighborhood won't provoke a counterreaction, regardless of region of the world, ideology of regime. That's really the argument.
So okay, this is where I think what the realist argument breaks down, right? It's not thrusting our alliance. These are sovereign countries, and I think this is a fundamental misunderstanding or divergence of understanding between Russia and NATO, and it's not just the United States, right? So what happened is communism collapsed in 1989, and those were popular revolutions, right? That is not what happened in 1991 in the Soviet Union. They were not popular revolutions. There was some popular uprising. But these countries and the citizens of these countries quite consciously revolted against communist government and opted, for the most part, for democracy. They became sovereign governments, right? They can make their own choices. They chose, in the case, let's take Poland, to pursue membership in the European Union. That required passage of laws that made their economies more modern and also made their politics more liberal, right? And this happened to many East European countries, not all. So these are independent sovereign countries, as is Ukraine, making their own decisions to join NATO, and they have some history with Russia, of Russia invading, forcibly taking over and imposing a form of government on them that they do not have.
The Soviet Union invading.
Okay, the Soviet Union, but that's not what they'll say. They will say Russia, right? But and it's not just the Soviet Union, it was also the Russian Empire, right? And Poland went back and forth between, ruled by different people, including the Russian Empire at various times. So let's remember that. It's not us saying, okay, Poland, you know what? You're going to be a member of NATO, like it or lump it. That's not the way it happened, okay? But that's not how Russia sees it, because that's not how they understand international politics. They understand it in this realist great power terms. You forced them. You forced your alliance in. No, we didn't, actually. We set standards, and in fact, Georgia and Ukraine are not members of NATO. Now, have we made mistakes? Absolutely. I think in the Bucharest summit, it should never have been said, as the Bush administration did, Georgia and Ukraine will become members of NATO. First of all, that wasn't fair to Georgia and Ukraine, because it takes a lot of money to become a member of NATO, and it takes a lot of investment in their military, and they were nowhere near that. Not to mention not thinking through possible sensitivities, because now you're moving into republics of the former Soviet Union, right? So NATO expansion in and of itself, I don't think was necessarily a mistake. Because first of all, it stopped in 2005. So in 2014, for Putin to use that as a pretext for grabbing Crimea, part of sovereign Ukraine, is nonsense. And Mearsheimer saying that, you know, we did everything wrong, we should never have done that, and we took advantage just in the same way that Europe did after World War I with Weimar, you know, the failures of Weimar Germany. Okay, the other thing is, what did they get? Well, it's not true they got nothing for reaching out. And again, this is a grievance argument that Putin puts forward and that people like John Mearsheimer have drunk this lemonade, or Kool-Aid, I guess it is. Well, they got membership in the World Trade Organization in 2012. That's actually really good for Russia. That was good for Russia, and they would never have gotten it without the support of the United States, because frankly, the countries that we control, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, would never wanted them in the World Trade Association. What else did they get? They got membership in the G8. They got that in the 90s under the Clinton administration, when there was no way in H-E double hockey sticks because I'm Canadian, that the Russian economy was a candidate for membership in the G8. They're still members of the G20, although we've at least suspended membership in the G8 as part of our punishment over Crimea. What else did they get? They got aid. Did they get enough aid? No. And Americans, we were not the leaders in giving aid to Russia, but Germany was pretty darn good, and Germany's a member of NATO. What else did they get? They got trade. They also got, you know, you can criticize what we've done in Afghanistan. We didn't do it very well. The country's a mess, but it is actually somewhat, Russia did get some security benefit from what we did in Afghanistan, and they didn't pay for it. So in terms of what else we did wrong, well, I think we got distracted over Iraq and Afghanistan. We thought Russia was cooked and done. And, you know, it takes a long time to reform a country. In 25 years, on the one hand, I was incredulous with how far they've come, because I'm thinking of concrete things like being able to make a phone call or getting a cappuccino or, you know, Uber. I used Uber the last time I was in Moscow. My teenage son said, he shares an account with me, said, I did not just call an Uber in Moscow. And I said, that was me, it's okay. But in terms of 2017 and beyond, well, now I think the situation has changed, and it's an existential crisis for the Putin regime, because with the economy declining, he needs a new social contract. He can't, as I said, promise a better life. So what's happened is we see a new external enemy, or a renewed external enemy, and it is the West, and it is Western values. So it gets back to some of what Masha was saying. And so I think a lot of the external aggression is directly related to domestic politics. The easy rejoinder to that is, well, he has an 80% or 90% approval rating. It's very fragile. Before he invaded Crimea, it was about 60%. He goes into Crimea, it jumps literally in a week up over 80. And so this can change. The other problem, I think, is that there are no institutions that constrain decision-making at the central level anymore. There's no one to say, no, Vladimir, we shouldn't do that. And I think that's very dangerous, but it also makes the regime quite fragile in a way. And it's very different from the Soviet system, where there was at least a Politburo that, you know, wouldn't have done what they did in Syria. They wouldn't have gone in so quickly in this way. And so I think the danger for the new president on day one is that Russia has become more unpredictable. And it has capabilities that it is evidently willing to employ and that don't cost a ton of money. So it doesn't matter that its economy is not as great as it was 5 years ago.
Let me, Masha, cut you off, but let you have the first question, because I think it flows right from this. So I'm now fielding audience questions. Thank you very much. Sometimes I'm combining them. One listener asks, how much influence does the Orthodox Church have on Putin? And maybe you can consider that with another question that just asks about scapegoats, domestic society's anger. What else can be targeted? What do we expect in the future if Putin continues to ratchet up and the country slide towards totalitarianism? Church, minorities, internal enemies. I guess these are both asking you to prognosticate a bit.
Right. So the question about the church, I always get this question, and it's a very difficult one to answer because it's based on a fallacy, right? It's based on the fallacy that you can actually separate church from state in Russia and figure out what their relationship is. But they're like two arms attached to the same body. And they act in concert. Sometimes one is used more than the other. But the Russian Orthodox Church has always, including during the Soviet period, been a part of the state. And that's the way it's remained. Now, in terms of scapegoats, I'm not sure I quite understand the question, but...
Who might Putin target next, especially if the regime comes under more social pressure because the economy continues to stumble?
Well, I mean, there's no way to predict that, and that's the whole point, is that, you know, these scapegoats are always chosen at random, and it doesn't matter who's chosen, right? The LGBT community in Russia had no idea what was coming. There was nothing to indicate that this was going to happen to us, and then it happened. And it was a brilliant choice. You know, the LGBT community is a great stand-in for the West. Mm-hmm. for everything that's changed that makes us uncomfortable since 1991, for everything that's strange. It's great that the LGBT community is an invisible minority. It makes it all that much scarier. Because you know it's you've never met one, but they threaten your children, and it was also a brilliant choice because there had never been a public conversation about sexuality in Russia. So the moment the Kremlin started the conversation and owned the conversation, there was no language even in which to object. But really, you know, I left the Soviet Union as a teenager because of anti-Semitic discrimination. I had to make haste and leave 3 years ago with my family because of the anti-gay campaign. You know, it doesn't feel any different, and the rhetoric isn't really much different. And you can choose any other minority, and it will be just as effective. There will be more people targeted. That much I can say.
Next pair of questions I'm combining. Wonderful. Aside from oil and gas, wedding rings, and nesting dolls, what does Russia make that the rest of the world might buy? And in combination, with its high military spending, is Russia going to run out of financial resources within a few years? What will happen? Why so much military spending? So the future of the economy, in short.
Okay. So there are some things, actually. They're a big nickel producer and metals producer. Again, that is raw materials, however. And Russia has just become the world's biggest grain exporter, surpassing Canada. So that's new in the last year or so. What else does it have? Well, evidently some good, or maybe some good cyber capability. We don't know. So this is the problem, right? I've actually been in part of this book I've been working on also the shape of the Russian economy and whether Russian economic development could be sustainable in the longer term. And there's kind of an easy answer, which is no. So there are a couple of problems. First of all, and I think Russian policymakers often don't fully appreciate it, even if they can articulate it. So Mr. Putin will complain that, you know, and Medvedev did too, to some degree, that we didn't invest enough in Russia. Okay, well, the problem is that there are lots of places foreign business people can invest, right? You can invest in China, you can invest in Indonesia, you can, you know. Now, for oil and gas, you got to go where the oil and gas is. But for other things, you got to go where labor productivity is high and wages are low. And that's what people tend to do, right? And they want to make a profit. So I think that is something that's not fully appreciated and understood, and also the fact that rule of law and property rights are weak still in Russia. And this is something that we have jawed about for a long time, and the Russians have wrung their hands, and some things have gotten better. So if you look at the World Bank's Doing Business Index, Russia has improved on a lot of those measures. But it's still, as it got richer, it got more corrupt, not less corrupt. And it's partly also, I think, because the state got bigger. And so there are more opportunities for someone to grab a payoff or a bribe along the way. So corruption is a huge problem in terms of sustainable development for Russia. Lack of diversification is a huge problem. Relatively low labor productivity and high wages is another problem. Now, a lot of people will say in response, but they have such a great education system. Russia actually has the most number of engineers in the world. However, what are these engineers? What do they do? What does it mean to be an engineer in Russia? I know almost everyone I know is an engineer in Russia. And so the problem has been also a lack of, so research and development here in the United States, for example, comes from companies, right? It's Apple, it's Google, they're creating new products. In Russia, the research and development money has come from the state, and it's going into the Academy of Sciences, and it's not hooked up with private enterprise, and so that's another issue. So even though R&D spending has gone up, it's still relatively speaking quite low, and it's completely disengaged from money-making enterprises. And the quality of education has, in fact, gone down. So even though we have a high literacy rate, so if you just looked at that, Russia looks really good on literacy. But okay, people can read. What are you doing with that ability to read? Are they keeping up with technical skills? The problem, and they're not. And the problem is the rest of the world is moving forward as they move incrementally along. So innovation is low. It's not even an imitation economy.
I want to add one more thing on the economy. There is a common fallacy, again, that, if the economy tanks, then it will bring the regime down. And in fact, deficit economies are really good for stabilizing totalitarian societies. And so there's no sort of getting from here, from a bad economy to there, to regime change.
Yeah, and the Soviet economy stumbled along for years. I mean, ultimately, that's not really what it brought it down. It was tinkering and then failures. And it was reforms by Gorbachev that ultimately brought the system down.
We haven't got much time left, so I'm going to do my fusion magic again and combine two more. And I'll turn to Masha first, but Catherine as well. These guys will cut you off. I won't. But really briefly, if you can, how might Russia look when Putin is no longer in power? How might its domestic and foreign policies change and U.S.-Russian relations? But embedded in that, what reforms does Russia need to enact to have sustainable economic development? How can they diversify their economy? I know these sound different, but it's not going to happen under Putin. It sounds like both of you are pretty convinced that this is a path, a trajectory that's not going to suddenly be reformist. So after Putin, what comes economically and politically and on the international scene? What are the scenarios?
So very quickly, politically, I've actually just filed a column for the New York Times on this very topic of what happens after Putin, because eventually there will be an after Putin. Nobody lives forever, whatever he might think about this. I think that the longer Putinism goes on, the worse Russia's prospects for what happens after. And I assume you'll talk about the economy, but it's just that this has been so destructive to the fabric of society. And Russia has lost so many people. It's hemorrhaging talent. It's hemorrhaging young people. But it's also destroyed its language. It's destroyed its culture. It's done such violence to, it's destroyed its public space. So what can be built on this scorched earth is very difficult to imagine. It will be a much worse situation than in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that was bad. There are also major questions about Russia's territorial integrity. I don't believe for a second that after Putin, Russia will remain on its current borders. I mean, there's the issue of Crimea, which is illegally annexed, but there's the Far East, which has become increasingly culturally and economically oriented toward the East. There's the Caucasus, which is the entire North Caucasus, which is held in the Russian Federation through a combination of violence and huge investment. So I think that there will have to be, there's been a lot of pressure from the center under Putin to centralize power, but there have also been very powerful centrifugal forces as a reaction to that. And there we've seen independence movements pop up where there had never been independence movements before. So it will have to be renegotiated, and it's unlikely to be peaceful.
On that decidedly not optimistic, but absolutely realistic note, I conclude the session. I thank the panelists and remind you of our next session, America's Crisis of Identity, again back in the ballroom on the second floor. Thank you for wonderful questions, and thank you, Catherine and Masha, for wonderful insights.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured Marcia Gessen, journalist and author, and Catherine Stoner, senior fellow at Stanford University. They were in conversation with Robert English, associate professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Visit us at worldaffairs.org to share this episode, to register for upcoming events, or to join the World Affairs Council. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.